C+36. Drive-in, Birchwood, Colorado. I never wanted to be anyone's hero, Dan said, gazing at the giant screen as it played the familiar-to-everyone dashcam footage of the moment when he stumbled across the infamous Kerguelen folder outside of the old IDA building in Colorado Springs. I fell into all of this when I picked up that stupid folder on Winchester Street. But I'm also no villain. Someone once told me that sometimes doing the right thing is more important than being a slave to the truth, and a large part of me still believes that. Maria and Kyle from ACN, the friendly media faces Dan chose to focus on, looked predictably confused by his opening gambit. He hadn't expected anything else, but had wanted to get this thought off his chest. And with the introduction complete, he moved on. In any case, I'm here to show you the two things that Timo and Emma, and Trey Myers, tried to show you yesterday. I'm doing this live so no one else can twist it, and I'm doing it at all because, well, doing something is a lot better than doing nothing. Dan opened Timo's briefcase and lifted out the fourth plaque. He held it up while the slideshow transitioned to a close-up image of the engraving. We found the fourth plaque, he said as simply as he could, sending many in the crowd into a frenzy of jostling and drawing stunned expressions from the rest. Clearly, the messengers were telling us where in the sky to look for something. From the moment we found this, we thought it was going to lead us to New Kerguelen. You all know that Timo owns a lot of telescopes, but what you don't know is that we found Comet Conte Abate because this plaque told us where to look for it. Voices rose and bodies pushed forward. No one was trying to get at Dan, but every slight push from the back of the sardine-like mass of reporters had a knock-on effect, which destabilized many cameras and caused tensions to flare up along with the rising levels of amazement. Dan moved on quickly, trying to stay detached from the moment-to-moment crowd reactions and knowing that the important thing was what would happen when he finished these initial reveals, all of which were incredible to everyone else, but meant little to him or humanity's chances of having any future beyond the next 8 months. The relentless progress of his timed slideshow kept him on pace, and he followed along with his carefully written notes to explain that he was able to find the plaque itself only because the messengers told him where to look for that too. The next slide would contain Trey's footage of an alien craft flying over Lolo, and Dan fully expected it to generate the loudest gasps and most widespread jostling yet. I don't think the fourth plaque's location had anything to do with that old Fincher prophecy a lot of people believe in, he said. But I did find it in a mountain town, and one not all that far from where we're standing now. Anyway, I knew where to look for it because something happened in Lolo National Forest. The California Fireball's perigee was another signpost, but I'll get on to the significance of Lolo in a few minutes. First of all, I want you to see what happened there, just seconds after the junk satellite burned up over Montana. As the footage played, irrefutable given its quality and the variety of Trey's camera angles, Dan's predictions of how the crowd would react quickly came to pass. Although a large part of him thought that he personally would have been more interested in the plaque had he been on the other side of the situation, he could understand that this footage was more viscerally powerful than the sight of the fourth plaque, which was, after all, very much in keeping with the three plaques the public had seen before. This footage, on the other hand, was the very first real footage of a bona fide alien craft. UFO wasn't really the right word since Dan knew exactly what it was, but most of the crowd were so used to this term that it was the one at the front of their minds. And as for the significance of Lolo, Dan said, waiting for the slide to change, I've been there before. A video of Dan drawing a map to Lolo while sitting entranced in a crop circle then filled one half of the giant screen. A still image of the map filled the other. It was at this point that Dan caught sight of Phil Norris and Mr. Bird for the first time, off to the far edge of the lot on the other side of the crowd from Trey. He didn't know why his father wasn't with them, but the slideshow's relentless march meant that he didn't have time to think about it. Last year, immediately after the DS-1 disaster, I was directly contacted by the messengers, he said. It seemed now as though everyone was all gasped out. They were now simply entranced, appropriately enough, by everything they were seeing and hearing. I spoke to them through a cable they attached to my neck, and they told me what they had done. They destroyed DS-1, and they did it because it was the first stage of a project which would have eventually put nuclear weapons in space. The messengers are a non-interventionist race, and they threatened no harm, but they saw sabotaging that launch in China as the minimal intervention necessary to keep those weapons out of orbit. They've intervened on a few occasions since then, all very recently. First came the Kerguelen bolide to get our attention, and then came Montana and California. All of this was to lead us to the plaque, which ultimately led us to the comet. How that worked isn't the most important thing right now. If you're anything like me, what you want to know is why these things happened. And if I had the answer to that question, I would share it with you all in a heartbeat. But I can't pretend to understand why they were willing to intervene to show us the comet, but why at the same time, although they cared enough to show us, they haven't done anything to protect us. I can only assume, and it's my assumption alone, that physically interfering with another celestial body is too great an intervention. I can also only assume that the messengers very wrongly thought that we were in a better position to deal with this ourselves than we actually are. There was no longer any jostling. Various images and videos from Dan's trip to Lolo had the crowd enraptured as they listened to his words, despite none of his group's cameras having picked up the cloaked mothership on the other side of the threshold. But the slideshow was now mere seconds away from reaching its conclusion. "There's a reason I haven't talked about any of this before," Dan said, starting to get a little twitchy that it had gone on this long. "And that's precisely what I want to address next." From an already elevated level, his heart rate increased greatly as soon as he said this. As the very last slide appeared, it showed more images of the Lolo threshold Clark had marked with his heel, along with some footage of Emma and Dan venturing bravely beyond it. He looked down at Trey and very clearly mouthed, "Not yet," because the second presentation, if Dan was right, wouldn't be needed. He then moved on to the final part, the part he hoped he wouldn't have to finish, and the most difficult part of all. He knew the messengers had left it extremely late with Walker, so it wasn't yet time to panic. Slowly, Dan began to spit it out. "Everything you knew about the messengers before I started talking, everything that was in the folder, everything Walker ever said and everything he ever denied, every little bit of it." The gaps grew longer between each of Dan's reluctant utterances. He looked down at Clark, the only person present who had any idea what he was going through. Clark's face reflected the kind of torment Dan was feeling, and Dan knew that Clark must have felt even more helpless down there. Dan closed his eyes. He couldn't understand why, or even believe that the messengers were leaving it this late. But he again tried to focus on the knowledge that they didn't stop Walker until after his interview with Joe Crabb had begun, seconds before he was going to spill it. Dan's heart was beating like never before as he stood at the precipice. He didn't know where his next step would take him, or what exactly he was on the edge of, and the only way to find out was to try to force the words out. He braced himself to feel an intense pain or see a flash or perhaps even be abducted when the long, verboten words touched his lips. "All of it was... it was all..." he stammered again, once more struggling against his own doubts. With his eyes still closed, Dan then forced his mind to think of Ben Gold standing in his kitchen a year earlier, leaning against the wall and spitting out the same words for the greater good, without knowing what would come next. If Ben could do it. "It was a hoax," Dan said, booming out the words at twice the volume of anything else he'd said so far. "Every single bit of the initial story was a hoax by Walker and Closter, and every single one of us fell for it. It was all a hoax." Opening his eyes and praying to see a total white light, Dan instead saw hundreds of expressions like none he'd seen before. There was no flash, no pain in his neck, no abduction. The words were out, and nothing had happened. Dan McCarthy wished for the world to swallow him up as he muttered two more under his breath. "Oh, shit."